From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Hopefully, the party will take notice that we're not going to take this nonsense anymore and this sellout attitude.
I hope we're sending a very, very clear message. Look, I don't compromise my morals, but this nation is built on finding common ground. And that's what we have to do, is find common ground.
That's Republicans Mike Bost, and before that, his challenger, Darren Bailey. The two squared off in a primary that Bost won this week. It's just one of the races we'll talk about on State Week as we recap the primary election. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime Statehouse reporter and observer. And with us, once again, we have Brendan Moore. He covers government and politics for Lee Enterprises. And Brendan, always good to have you back with us.
Always happy to be on, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with that race I just talked about. Mike Bost, Republican incumbent. He's been in office for about a decade. He was going up against the former Republican nominee for governor, Darren Bailey, the 12th Congressional District. And Bost is pretty conservative in a conservative district, but he faced that challenge from Bailey. Bost won. What did you take away from it?
Well, Sean, I think obviously one of the big takeaways is that obviously Mike Bost won, but barely. I mean, he won by, according to the Associated Press, it's about 2,500 votes, about a 51 to 49% spread. And this is a guy that, again, has been an incumbent member of Congress since 2015. He had basically every advantage you would want to have going into an election. He had huge money advantage. He had significant institutional support from groups like the National Rifle Association and National Right for Life. And he had the backing of Republican leadership in Washington. And most importantly, he had the Trump card. He had former President Donald Trump's endorsement, which, you know, goes a long way in a district that voted for the former president. So he had pretty much everything you would want in a Republican primary, yet Bailey still came within a few thousand votes of knocking him off. And so the story really is that not really that Bost survives, it's that Bailey, despite having the deck totally stacked against him, came within a very small amount of knocking off an incumbent member of Congress, who, as you mentioned, Sean, is a very conservative person. This is not a situation like we had a couple years ago with Rodney Davis and Mary Miller, where Rodney Davis had to take some more moderate votes because of his district. Mike Bost is very Trumpy, very conservative guy. The only difference would be that it more in style than in substance, because him and Bailey agree on most of the issues. But Bost is what he would describe himself as, a governing conservative, whereas he would say, like, yes, I'm a conservative guy, but in divided government, we have to compromise sometimes to get things done. Whereas Bailey is more of a non-governing conservative, but perhaps more of a bomb thrower in the ilk of a Matt Gaetz or a Mary Miller. He would have joined the Freedom Caucus, and he would have been more of a disruptor. So I think the big takeaway here is that, yes, Bost won, but Bailey is not going to go away, or at least folks in the mold of Darren Bailey. Mike Bost is going to have to be looking over his shoulder the next 2 years, every 2 years from now, if he wants to keep that seat.
Yeah, Charlie, what does this say about the Republican Party right now, in the sense that I would bet Mike Bost and many of the people that voted for Darren Bailey agree on 90%+ of the issues? But if the problem is, as we heard Darren Bailey say at the start there, sellout attitude, that's what he said, we're not going to put up with a sellout attitude. If that is trying to compromise, trying to govern, that doesn't bode well for, in my opinion, democracy going forward if people feel that way.
No, it really doesn't. And in my time covering the legislature, there were maybe a handful of people who were that way, who would rather go without than take half a loaf. And the ones who I always thought were the best in terms of shaping public policy were the ones who were willing to compromise with people who didn't necessarily view the issues the same way they did and agree to get something done and then come back next time and try and move the ball a little further. But in Bailey's case, he strikes me as someone who does not want to yield even an inch. And it's interesting that that congressional district, if I'm not mistaken, is the largest one in Illinois. It's thousands upon thousands of square miles. It covers basically the bottom third of the state. And the vote pattern was that you could take that district and draw a line from north to south, from top to bottom. The counties on the west side of the line, Bost won. The counties on the east side, Bailey won pretty handily. The difference is that the east side of the district has fewer people. The west side, where Bost lives, has Carbondale and the St. Louis suburbs. As you said earlier, Sean, if you would stack them up and say, where do you stand on all these positions, you'd be hard pressed to find an area where there was substantial disagreement on policy between Bost and Bailey. The disagreement would be on whether or not we should cooperate with anybody to try and advance our cause bit by bit rather than hold out until we get the whole enchilada. And interestingly, both Bailey and Bost were elected as Trump delegates for the Republican National Convention this summer in Milwaukee. So they'll be on the same team there.
They can carpool up there together, I guess. But go ahead, Brendan, you wanted to weigh in again.
Yeah, no, I agree with Charlie that, I mean, if you look at the map, it is quite the contrast between, say, the Metro East and Little Egypt down by Carbondale, versus the Wabash Valley, where in the eastern part of the district, you know, and it should be noted that Mike Bost, you know, even before he was elected to Congress, represented a lot of the areas that he won significantly in the state legislature. So they know him very well there. And then Darren Bailey, obviously in the state legislature, represented a lot of the areas that he did really well in. So it was about the maybe the familiarity aspect of it. But you're right that, I mean, former President Trump has endorsed both these candidates in the past. They both endorsed him in this race, in his race for president. And it really seemed like at times this was a race about a competition of who could hug the former president a little bit tighter. Every time something would come out about the former president's legal cases or whatever, they would both be out with, you know, social media posts defending the former president, posting pictures of themselves with him. You know, that was really the big, it was really kind of a sight to see, if you will. But obviously he ultimately went with Bost, and you know what, that might have been just enough for Mike Bost to keep his seat. But you're right, there really wasn't much of a difference in terms of where these candidates are on the issues or who they support for president. It was about style, honestly. You know, Bailey tried to position himself as a fighter, and, you know, we'll see if he continues the fight in 2 years, whether that's another run for Congress or maybe another run for governor. But I don't think this is the last we've seen of Darren Bailey.
All right, well, let's switch to another part of the state. And Charlie, we talked about this last week, what's been a highly watched ballot measure that was called Bring Chicago Home. And it had the support of Chicago's mayor and a lot of others because it would have taxed some high-end property sales a little bit higher than they're taxed now. And the extra money would then go to pay for some programs to help the homeless, also for more affordable housing. That looks like that's failed. That's a pretty big defeat, it seems to me, for the mayor of Chicago. Last numbers I saw looked about 54% against. And what this would have done, I should be clear on this, it would have given the Chicago City Council the authority to raise that real estate transfer tax. So it wouldn't have been a done deal if it passed, but would have given them that authority. What's your takeaway, Charlie, on this?
Well, I think it is a big defeat for Mayor Brandon Johnson. The votes aren't all in yet, but it's clear that it's going to go down. Johnson, in a press conference the following day after the election last Wednesday, he vowed that he was going to keep fighting, and he would refuse to, what would you say, be at all chastised by the vote. He said that there were a lot more yeses in the neighborhoods most impacted by the housing crisis, and he suggested that the more well-to-do folks in the city voted against it, whereas the folks who would be most helped by it, the people with inadequate housing or in neighborhoods that are gentrifying, were pretty much in favor of it. But he refused to say, he was questioned about this by reporters, he wouldn't say whether or not he would try to do it again in November, and he wouldn't also speak to whether or not they would attempt to rephrase the referendum question to make it more readily understandable. There was some concern about the way it was written that wasn't really clear what exactly it was saying. And so the critics argued that you really don't specify what's going to happen, and you've not really told us what you would do with this estimated $100 million in new money that would come in. And he was hammered on that issue. And there was a constitutional challenge filed against it by the opponents, business owners, realtors, folks like that, arguing that it was unconstitutional because it combined two different issues. And in the referendum, you're only supposed to have one. The issues being, we're going to increase, we'll have this graduated rate, we're going to increase the transfer tax on properties valued at $1 million or more. The excess above $1 million would be taxed at graduated levels. And we're going to give a very small discount to anything under $1 million. And the argument was, those are two separate issues and you can't combine them in the same referendum. So the courts cleared the referendum. Well, it was challenged, and the court said, well, we're going to go ahead and go ahead and take the votes, and we'll address the issue. What was left unsaid was what would happen if this passes, when it would be challenged again. And he, as I say, he was very adamant that he was going to keep pushing for this. Well, and they asked, does this mean your progressive agenda is in trouble? And here's his quote. If anyone believes that one issue that we still have to address is going to cause me to put the brakes on my agenda, well, they missed the city council today, because we are moving forward with a $1.25 billion bond deal that's going to invest in people, because that's what I promised that I was going to do. And that's what I'm doing. And that's what I will continue to do. So guess what? Buckle up. So he's not been at all set back by this. And they're going to continue to push forward. My guess is they'll try again in November, and they will reword the referendum to make it clearer what they're attempting to do. And they may do away and just talk about the tax on an increased tax rate for properties valued over $1 million, and forget about giving this very tiny break to properties less than that.
My guess is we may see a higher turnout around that time, too. Chicago, I think, got about 20% turnout, pretty low this time. And some of the other places in the state where there weren't any real competitive races, like Sangamon County here, didn't have much going on. One Republican primary for the 13th Congressional District. But outside of that, the turnout was less than 14% here. So, Brendan, should we read anything into this low voter turnout? Anything that's concerning? Maybe people aren't motivated by just this election, or is it, a sign of something else?
Yeah, I wouldn't read too much into it necessarily. Obviously, in primaries, we tend to see higher turnout when there are more races on the ballot. This time, obviously, we had race for president, but both sides, it's basically been decided who the candidates are going to be. There were no other statewide races for like governor or Senate, for instance, to bring people out. As you mentioned, Sean, I mean, I know I'm, the ballots I had to choose from, there was maybe one race that was contested. So there just weren't a lot of reasons to bring people out to the polls. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I did talk to the folks from the State Board of Elections the other day, just to kind of get an idea of where turnout was and kind of how it compares to past turnout. And it was pointed out that, turnout wasn't all that great in 2020 either, because it was a similar situation of former President Trump was the nominee on the Republican side, and, Biden was Bernie Sanders was still in, but Biden was on the way to being the nominee. But we had one of the highest turnouts in decades in the general election. So a low turnout in a primary is not necessarily an indicator of what's going to happen in the general election, when clearly there are some pretty high stakes on the ballot in November. But I think it may be more of a indictment on the lack of competitive races. I think if we had a more robust primary on the Republican side, you know, that would have brought folks out on that side of things. And I mean, same thing on the Democratic side. I think, you know, perhaps there is something maybe to be said about how our legislative districts are so gerrymandered that, quite frankly, there's just not, a lot of competitive districts, and, you know, incumbents tend to run unopposed, with a few glaring exceptions. But besides a few places around the state, there just was not a lot of marquee matchups that made people interested in turning out to vote this time around.
Let me try to recap a few more races here real quick. Up in Cook County, state's attorney's race there, that one is still too close to call, so by next week's show we should be able to mention that. Also, Charlie, a state representative, you've known her. She's been in office since 1985, I believe she took over, and that was, of course, when Harold Washington was mayor of Chicago. Mary Flowers, Democrat from Chicago, defeated by Michael Crawford. She had sort of fallen out of favor with the Illinois House Speaker, and he was working actively against her in this primary. In fact, let me read from the Chicago Sun-Times story. The race became a proxy for Chris Welch's power to control his own members. Welch and Democrat-supporting unions backed Crawford, raising a whopping $1.7 million more than Flowers has raised in total over the last 30 years. So, Charlie, what did you think about the outcome here with Mary Flowers getting defeated?
In a way, I was saddened because Mary Flowers was someone who I knew and was a good source for me. While the time I was at the Sun-Times, she arrived on the scene in 85 and I left in 93. And so, as I say, she was a good conduit for me for what thinking was on in that particular area and Black issues, progressive Black issues. But she ran afoul of Speaker Welch, and there were suggestions that she had been abusive to staff, and he bumped her from her leadership position, forbid her to participate in caucus meetings, and it was pretty clear that he was going to support someone against her. And Michael Crawford, who beat her, he's an administrator at a private university in Chicago, and he won by roughly a 2-to-1 margin. And it's very unusual for a speaker to, or a legislative leader, to go against someone in his own caucus. The obvious thing that comes to mind was a few years ago when Mike Madigan took out Ken Duncan. And the reason there was because Ken Duncan, who was a Democratic representative from the South Side, had been voting with Bruce Rauner on some controversial issues. But there was none of that with Mary Flowers. She was just seen as a problem by Welch, and they put a ton of money in her race to knock her out. The other surprise, the other incumbent who lost, Mary Flowers is the longest serving member of the House. The other incumbent who lost was a senator from the Northwest side, Natalie Toro. And she is, if not the newest, one of the newest. She was appointed last summer in July, I believe, to replace Senator Christiana Passione Zayas, who went to work for Brandon Johnson. Toro was beaten by Graciela Guzman, who had the support of the progressive wing. Bernie Sanders came out and worked for her. Toro had about 30%. And in her case, Senate President Don Harmon went all out to try and keep her in the district. He and other members of his leadership team put something more than $2 million into her campaign funds. But in the grand scheme of things, in terms of the partisan breakdown, it makes no difference in that both Crawford, who's replacing Flowers, and Guzman, who's replacing Toro, are going to win in November. Those districts are overwhelmingly Democratic. And to be honest, I'm not even sure if there's Republicans running in them. But I say it was interesting because Harmon did what you would expect a leader to do, what leaders do traditionally. They back all their incumbents. And that kind of an unwritten rule. If you're an incumbent of my party, I'm going to back you. And the fact that Welch went after Flowers was really a deviation from what's been standard operating procedure for many, many years.
Brendan, I wanted to get your thoughts on some races as we come back downstate. These were some really hardcore Republicans, some, you know, the Freedom Caucus, people like to talk about. There, some call them the Eastern Bloc over there. Some of them were facing primary challenges as well, but this were a little different primaries. So fill us in on that and what took place.
Down in southeastern Illinois, there were a couple of really interesting primaries in some of the most conservative districts in the state. So we had incumbent state reps Blaine Wilhauer and Adam Niemerg, who are members of the far-right Illinois Freedom Caucus. It had been known as the Eastern Bloc in past years too, which is kind of a sub-caucus within the Republican Party of the most conservative folks in the legislature. And they had significant primary challenges that were financially bankrolled by the state's teachers unions. These two folks have been foes of the teachers unions agendas. They have obviously spoke out very vehemently against masking in schools during COVID. They were, proponents of extending the tax credit for private school scholarships, you name it. So they were targeted. The teachers unions, the Illinois Education Association, and the Illinois Federation of Teachers combined to put in, I believe, it was about $200,000 into these races. They outspent Wilhauer and Niemerg. I should add an added wrinkle to the Niemerg race is that he had to run as a write-in candidate because he got tossed from the ballot because he failed to notarize his statement of candidacy. So that was an all write-in race. But in both cases, it didn't matter. The incumbents both won decisively. Last I checked, Wilhauer had about 79% of the vote against his union-backed opponent, and they're still counting the write-in ballots in Niemerg's race, but he had well over 80% against his union-backed write-in challenger. So it really was the teachers' unions tried to teach a lesson to these far-right legislators in these ruby red districts, but at the end of the day, they're the ones that got schooled. Although they did strike a defiant tone the day after conceding defeat, but very, very good result for the Freedom Caucus. They protected their little sphere of influence here down in southeastern Illinois.
Well, just about a minute left here. Brendan, while we have you on the show, I wanted to get your take on this as well. You wrote about this. The governor's got a plan out to rebuild a couple of prisons, Stateville and the Logan Correctional Center. There's a lot of concern, though, over this, especially in Logan County, because there's some thought that maybe the prison won't be rebuilt there. What would happen to the jobs? What have you heard so far?
Obviously, these plans are preliminary. They're in the governor's capital budget, so it has to be approved by the legislature. But basically, they would call for the rebuilding of Stateville and of Logan. These are some of the oldest facilities in the Department of Corrections system. They are in dire need of upgrades, and it would make more sense to build new facilities. The Department of Corrections has concluded there is less clarity on Logan. Apparently, there still have to be discussions with stakeholders about, where that facility would be built. Would it be rebuilt right next to it, or would it be relocated somewhere? Obviously, in the meantime, what's going to happen to the prison population that is there? Are they going to be transferred to other facilities, or what's going to happen to the employees? As we know, those of us live downstate, prisons are often a key economic engine for a lot of these communities. They provide a lot of the jobs, and obviously that gives people disposable income to support local businesses. Leaders in Logan County are rightfully concerned about, you know, the plans for Logan. But again, it's early, so we're going to have to wait and see what other details emerge as this goes forward.
Okay, we'll keep watching that. And it's time now for our notes from the field. Charlie, let's go to you first.
Well, this weekend, Governor Pritzker is heading out west. He's going to California to promote Illinois to the film industry and to businesses. And he's going to go with Illinois film officials. He wants to meet with major studios to discuss the state's film industry tax credit, which in 2022, and these are the latest numbers available, helped bring in roughly $700 million in film production expenditures. And he also wants to meet in San Francisco with tech leaders to talk about the state's investment in quantum computing and manufacturing. And oh, by the way, he's also going to fundraise for the Democratic convention in Chicago in August, and also for a couple of abortion initiatives on the ballot in Arizona and in Nevada, I believe is the other one. So he's going to have a busy, I think he's going to be out there most of the week. But the goal is obviously to bring more Hollywood and independent filmmaking to Illinois.
And Brendan.
Yeah, so obviously in the primary results last week, not a huge contest in the presidential race. Both former President Trump and President Biden won their primaries easily. But if you look within the numbers, there are signs of concern for both. Former President Trump got about 80% of the statewide vote, but in some of the key suburban counties, he only got, in Lake County and in DuPage County, he only got about 72% of the vote. And Nikki Haley got about a fifth of the vote, about a little over 20%, which may be a sign of continued weakness in the suburbs for the former president, a sign that some Republicans still have concerns with him. And then President Biden did well overall, but there were a not insignificant amount of folks in Chicago that simply did not vote in the presidential race, which might be a sign of some concerns among some of the progressives over his handling of the war in Gaza. Obviously, Illinois is going to go blue in November in all likelihood, but might be, you know, you could say DuPage County, Lake County, very similar to suburbs in, you know, outside of Philadelphia and Detroit and Milwaukee, that might swing the presidential race. And then obviously on the Democratic side, you know, in Chicago, I mean, it's a sign of, you know, in some of these other cities that perhaps there could be some weakness for the president. So just some things to look at as we move forward and go to the general election.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of State Week. Thanks for being with us. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Brendan Moore of Lee Enterprises. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and don't forget to join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.